My name is Emma Miller, and today is Monday, October 9th, 2017. I'm interviewing Mr. Danny Bell at Davis Library in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, about his life and his work assisting Native American students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Danny, can you introduce yourself?
Danny Bell, or I'm officially James Daniel Bell, Jr., Lumbee and Kaharie tribes of eastern North Carolina, and I live now in Chapel Hill.
Great. And do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Can you just start by telling me a little bit about where you grew up?
Starting before I grew up, my mother is Lumbee from Prospect section of the Lumbee Nation area out of Pembroke, North Carolina, and she graduated from Pembroke State College for Indians in 1945. Her first job was teaching at the Indian High School in Sampson County in Clinton. This is one of the third Indian high schools in North Carolina, a third system. Cherokee's had a high school, Lumbee's had one, but this high school in Sampson County was a regional Indian high school. It was one kind called the Seven County Indian School. And my father was a Kaharie from that area. And so I grew up a mile or two away from the school and went to that school for 11 years until they integrated the American Indians into the local white school. This is 2 years before the African Americans were introduced. So I lived in the Indian community there. Indian church, Indian school, and mostly segregated environment.
Great. What are your parents' names, and what did they do when you were growing up?
My mother is Mary Jacobs. She was a school teacher all her life. She taught for 20 years at the Indian school, and then with integration, she taught for 10 years at the local white school. She also made baskets. She was an excellent cook, gardening, you know, had a green thumb, and very active in the church and social part of the community. My father was a World War II veteran, served in New Guinea. He had, you know, PTSD from that, came home, but he was... So he had some issues around the service, but he was a farmer. We farmed tobacco, corn, other big vegetables, and also is an outdoorsman. He's one of the, hunter and fisher all year round, someone that everyone depended on to have a good time and to catch some fish for our fish fries.
Great. Do you have any siblings?
I have one brother, Philip. He's lives in Clinton, close to where we grew up, and he was retired recently from working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for 30 years.
Okay. I know that you said that your mother is a member of the Lumbee tribe and your father is a member of the Kaharie tribe. How would you identify yourself?
As both. It's hard to separate yourself from your families and have a large family, extended family on both sides. You know, for enrollment purposes, we're supposed to pick a tribe and you can only be enrolled in one tribe, but I know a number of people in the West and federally recognized tribes and others that have found a way to enroll in both tribes, but I'm as much a Kaharie as I am a Lumbee, but I did live among the Kaharie growing up, and so that is, you know, has a special place for me from fishing on the river and just everything that went on with that environment.
Can you tell me a little about your experiences attending segregated Native American schools for most of your education?
It was, from what I can remember, it's a long time ago, but it was... The classes were, you know, as organized as they were when my senior year with the white school. Everything worked about the same. It was, we had four or five Indian communities around that where students came to the school from, and some students, And so there was just, I guess, the normal environment. We did not have a lot of the technology that was available at the white school. In the beginning, we didn't have a gym. The state built a gym for us. We didn't have a cafeteria, so they brought in warm meals. We didn't have a baseball or other kinds of outdoor structured arenas, but we found a way to entertain ourselves, and the teachers made a major effort to keep us on task and help us learn what we needed to do to be successful in life.
Absolutely. What classes did you take, and what were your teachers like?
The classes were basically the curriculum of the state. Our textbooks were standard textbooks, even though they were hand-me-downs from the local white school. They always had white students' names where they signed each year for the textbooks. Our teachers tried to prepare us for contemporary society, so it was just not a real emphasis on the Indian culture or history. There were things drawn in from time to time, local information, but it was just basic curriculum that the teachers had learned when they were taking classes to prepare to be teachers.
I learned in my research, and you mentioned that you attended a predominantly white school for the first time when you were a senior in high school. Can you tell me a little more about your feelings at that time and your experience there?
Well, it's the big unknown if to go to a new school, and the environment was a challenge. We were not the first class to go to the local white school. The school allowed Indian students to go for about 2 years before we went. I went because our school was closed. We had no other choice. For about 2 years previous to that, Indian parents could elect to send their children to the local white school. We had, most people were friendly. There was not as much, fighting or challenges as I thought. One thing that helped us, my cousin, Christopher Hiawatha Bell, was a star athlete. He was the kind of guy that, you know, people would not mess around with. And he was just, football season starts at the beginning of school. We practiced and joined the team, and he went out, and he was a star athlete. And so that, I think, took the edge off a little bit. But, I had driven a school bus previous to coming to that for the Indian school, so I substituted for one of the local, one of the white girls that was driving a school bus. And so some of the guys were, a little hostile, but it's just the same thing if I had transferred to a Indian school somewhere. There would have been some of the same issues about, those new boys around here. Some did explain to me about the all the guns they had, and I was thinking, wow, we have a lot of guns too. We like to hunt, and are successful at it. So it was a real challenge in a lot of ways, but the teachers were about the same as the teachers we had at the Indian school. There were not any major difference in the curriculum or in the instruction. I remember one class where we had an open book test, and that was unusual because we never had an open book test at the Indian school, but this is just one teacher. But overall, it was a new world of experience that we survived and learned about the future engagement that we're going to have with other cultures and communities.
Do you remember any instances of maybe not you, but other people experiencing any discrimination when you moved to the predominantly white school?
I don't remember. There was so much going on. I think a lot of times we want to be social, and we did have homework to do, but I don't remember myself, experiencing anything that I remember. I'm sure others might have, but my mother's a school teacher, so I knew to behave in class and not to create issues to come back to me later. But I have heard of other students at other schools that did, but I don't remember myself having that challenge of discrimination then.
Okay. What inspired you to attend Eastern Carolina University?
Well, everyone was going to college if you could, and so after the SAT and all the other preparation, that was, and I guess I chose to go to East Carolina rather than maybe Pembroke, because I knew a lot of people going to Pembroke, and I thought I wanted a new adventure, or just see something a little bit different. And the name was the same as our school, East Carolina Indian School and East Carolina College. So I don't know what all went into it, but it was just see something different, maybe.
Are you comfortable speaking about your time in Vietnam?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your time serving over there?
Well, it was to go prepare for, I was drafted, and then my cousin, who Christopher Hiawatha Bell, was killed. He died in Vietnam, and so being drafted, everyone usually went to infantry. But I didn't want to go infantry, so I had a choice to be a clerk, a cook, or mechanic. And since I could type, I decided to be a clerk. So service in Vietnam was a challenge in that it's like everyone has the same kind of challenge. But there's a number of situations that we it was, thinking back today, this past few weeks was the Burns show on Vietnam War, and it shared a lot of information that I did not know about when I was in Vietnam. And I think that we have to, with the Silent Sam issues that are facing us now, and we have to look. I might have been a Silent Sam over in Vietnam. I mean, I didn't shoot anyone, but we all serve in different capacities in different situations. And but Vietnam was an experience that the horrors of the war, and I've heard about before seeing the Burns show, but I think that maybe there's lessons to be learned, and I hope that we learn those going forward in this country.
Do you think being Native American affected your time in the military?
Not too much. I mean, I was in the Army for 6 years total, and in the National Guard for 26 years. And I was not white or black. And so I skirted in the middle of those two groups in ways that I think sometimes that I was able to communicate with both separately. In a way that they could not. I mean, it was just real interesting sometimes. I was with the white guys, and they were talking about the blacks a little bit. I was with the black guys a little bit, and they'd talk about the whites. And so it's just sort of in the middle, and it's not something I would share information, but I was able to journey through with both groups without much of a problem. And you never would have expected American Indians to be able to run faster and longer and have superior athletic skills and other skills. And I had some by growing up hunting and fishing, but I was just an average soldier that just sort of wanted to get along and not have any hostility directed my way.
Did you know any other Native American soldiers during your time other than your cousin?
Yes, there was a number of friends from home that served in the armed services, some in Vietnam, some in Germany, at different places. And I've met a number of people after serving in the war that have told me about their experience. And but I did not know any American Indians that served with me when I was in the service, not in the Army. And in the National Guard, I'd see people once in a while, but not too often, that were American Indian.
So what inspired you to join the National Guard after serving in Vietnam?
Well, I was working at the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs in Raleigh, and one of my co-workers was in the Guard and asked me if I wanted to make a little extra money by joining the National Guard. I thought, well, I have the extra time, so why not? And so this is the 440th Army Band, and they needed an administrative assistant, someone. So since I had that skill from the service in the Army, I thought, well, it'd be interesting. And then also the National Guard Band at that time was traveling to different places, and they just had a trip planned for the Virgin Islands. So I thought, wow, I could join the National Guard and travel and see some places. So I joined, and we traveled to a number of places in Europe and South America. And so it was got to be fun.
Can you tell me a little more about your job at the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs in Raleigh?
Well, after East Carolina College, I worked for 1 year with Best Products, and then I had a cousin working with the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs, and I was always, you know, curious about Indian history. You know, it's just like I didn't know anything much, and I thought, well, working with some Indian people would be fun, and it'd be interesting. So I heard some people and some of the activities of the commission, and so I wanted to learn more. So that opportunity came up, and I worked in a number of different, I guess not departments, but programs, from public information, community surveys, employment and training, VISTA volunteer program. And so that was one of the best experiences of my life, working with the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs, to learn about the issues that American Indians face, to learn the history and the lack of history of American Indians in North Carolina. And, you know, I grew up, we were state-recognized Indians, but not federally recognized, and so the whole issue of Indian history came to me in that experience at the Commission of Indian Affairs, and the experience of finding out about all the different tribes, and it was really most beneficial to me.
I want to go back to you mentioned about being state recognized and not federally recognized. How do you think that had an impact on your tribe?
Well, federal recognition does, you know, it's sort of like the gold standard, you know, for being an American Indian. And sometimes the issues are that if you're not federally recognized, you're not a real Indian. But you know, when you really look at the engagement between the explorers and people from Europe and American Indians of this country when they came over, we were sort of the first ones to make contact on the East Coast. And so but the issue, and so we did not have as many treaties to engage in, or did not have did not have the opportunity to hold out get the federal recognition. If we were on the West Coast, it'd have been totally different. We would have been recognized, federally recognized. But state recognition is, to us, everyone knew, we knew we were American Indian. We went to Indian schools, had churches, we had customs and traditions that still maintain that gave us that connection. And at one time, there was a little bit of a feeling that there was something missing, but then when you look at the relationship between the federal government and American Indians, federal recognition does not make that much of a big difference. It does for gaming. You know, a lot of people have made some tribes in the right locations have made a lot of money to help their tribe and their community by gaming, but there's a lot of tribes that have federal recognition that live in isolated areas in the West, and they're still suffering. They are not don't have the standard of living that you think that being federally recognized does. I'm okay with the state recognition. I would like to see federal recognition, but I think we have a lot of work to do to with state recognition that can be beneficial, and we should be proud of whatever we have that is able to keep us connected to our past and our present and to the future, you know, engagement around our issues.
Absolutely. I'm going to transition now into some questions about UNC.
Yes.
So what brought you to UNC?
Well, I was at the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs on soft money. You know, we're always writing new grants, and so it's the end of funding cycle, and I had married, and we had a child, and here in Chapel Hill, my wife is going back to graduate school, so we needed, I was needed in Chapel Hill to help with the child care and helping to make that arrangement, and so looking at jobs, there was a job opening with the student aid office, so I applied and was accepted as a loan collector and loan disperser with the Student Aid Scholarships and Student Aid Office. And that was, it was a good, I was able to start working just a couple of months after leaving the Commission of Indian Affairs, and served me well, I think, for 7 years, learning a lot about the university and issues around student financing.
How did you get contacted to be part of the American Indian and Indigenous Studies program here at UNC?
Well, coming to Carolina and working with the Student Aid Office, the Loan Office, I did not sever any connections or engagement with the American Indian community. I still maintain some ties there. And I tried to find any Indian faculty, staff, or students on campus. So I got to know a few students, and I met the first, as far as I know, Indian staff that were working at Carolina. And so I just sort of hung around and stayed involved in that way, and met other people around campus. Met a few faculty and a few administrative staff that were interested in American Indians. So. I was lucky enough to be involved in a couple of activities with Professor Townie Luddington. And so when his effort and other administrative efforts were made to do some surveys and get information about American Indians, I was lucky to be around and able to provide some information about the local Indian tribes, since I'd worked with most of the tribes at the Commission of Indian Affairs. So that opportunity came, and the position opened, and I was able to join that effort.
Do you remember the names of any of the other, you said perhaps the first Native American faculty on campus besides Townie Luddington that were there helping you?
We did not have any American Indian faculty when I came to Carolina. There is on record a faculty member back in 88, but I know that the students and I reached out to this person and they never responded. And we know they got in touch with us, but there were a couple of staff members. I know Anthony Locklear was working with students' success in the College of Arts and Sciences, and but as far as faculty, there were none when I first came here that were engaged with American Indian students. And I got a list of faculty that were or people around, and anytime there's activities, I tried to reach out. Now, when I was with the student scholarships and student aid, I did not have that responsibility, but when I started with American Indian Studies, I tried to reach out to everyone that was at the university to be engaged in American Indian Studies. And so slowly, we started some faculty employed at Carolina.
Why did you want to help start the program?
Well, it was going to benefit me, but also it's a missing link. Carolina, over the years, you know, everyone talks about diversity and talks about minority issues. And so it was, we were missing, I thought, in most of those activities. And so it was a way to help. And a lot of this came from working at the Commission of Indian Affairs. When I was over there, we were aware of what was missing in the history of American Indians in North Carolina and the whole Southeast. And we were aware of how we were not involved in those issues. And so I care that looking at Carolina, I saw all the wonderful things going on, but then there were no Indian faculty, there were no Indian courses. We were missing in a lot of the programs that were going, or most all of the programs going on at Carolina. So it was seemed like a natural to be involved, and that was one of the things that sort of that I was charged with, was to keep a connection with the Indian community to help faculty and research and support also for American Indian students, that in a way to bringing in resources that might understand what challenges they have and how to help them to be successful.
Can you discuss some of the challenges that you faced while trying to create the program?
Well, the big problem, I guess, that sort of continues is that most people don't know anything about American Indians. They don't know the number, the history of American Indians. Even today, most people that, you know, and a lot of people move into the area from outside the state, and so they don't know the history, but even people from within North Carolina don't know much about us. And then there's the efforts toward diversity and inclusion are sometimes a one-size-fits-all, and we need, you know, the challenges, we need a focus on American Indians in the same way that there was a focus on African Americans. And the focus on American Indians needs the challenges looking at all the different tribes. I mean, one effort can't really address all the differences of our tribes, from the mountains, the Cherokees on the mountains, to the Waccamaw Siouan and the Lumbee on the toward the coastal areas. And then, you know, the other challenges is just with not understanding American Indians, there's the challenge of terms that they use. I mean, in academia and, you know, in society, there's a lot of use of the term people of color and communities of color. But those terms were terms used in the 1700s, 1800s to not identify us as American Indians. So in a way that it's not a enduring and a term that American Indians use for ourselves. And the challenges of how do we get work, how do we get the American Indian communities engaged in higher education. Now, any complaints I make about Carolina, you'd be aware that Carolina is doing more for American Indians than probably any other university in the state. And there's so much more to be done all across the state. But, you know, since I work here, I'm aware of some things, but we're doing more with the American Indian Center, with the courses we have offered here, the faculty, American Indian and the non-Indian faculty, and then a number of wonderful people from the Southern Oral History Program in Wilson Library, to the Center for the Study of the American South, the Research Labs of Archaeology. There's just a number of wonderful programs around Carolina to support American Indians themselves, but also non-Indians to learn about us. But then we're missing, faculty in the arts. We've not had a performing arts program with an American Indian group in 10 years, 20, 15 years. Just a number of places that we need attention to, and I think it's coming that way, but it's just, we always want things to move faster than they actually are, but we are moving much faster than any other school in the state. So I have a concern, but I have a celebration that we are doing some good things here.
Absolutely. Did you...
go ahead.
Did you receive any pushback from the administration when you were trying to create the program?
I didn't, but I was not an administrator. Professor Towney Ludington was, instrumental in developing the program, recognizing it. I know that he had a postdoc fellow that was doing a course on American Indian Studies, Blythe Forsey, I think was her name. And there were the provost at that time was interested in including us, and some of the dean of anthropology might have been. I mean, there's a lot of support, but I didn't get any pushback. People didn't really know how I fit into the whole scheme of things. I was not faculty. I was sort of a staff that was showing up at a number of different functions, but I thought that the more people saw me, they might question and be receptive to a conversation about our presence here or issues that might be helpful to us.
Definitely. I know you mentioned terminology being an important issue and a challenge that you have faced and that the Native American community has faced. Is there a specific terminology that you would prefer people to use that you think is the best term to use?
Well, for me, I think I like the terms, anything that's not derogatory, that's along the lines of American Indian was one of the first terms used to describe us. I mean, just sort of a pan-Indian term, mm-hmm. as is Native Americans, but they can be used interchangeably, but anyone talking about Indians should, and Indians, but you have to be, there's Indian Americans that are not American Indians, so it depends on where you are when you're talking about it, but a lot of people do want to recognize their tribes, and to, when you're talking about us, be tribally specific whenever you can, and use terms that engage with the community, find out what is the preferred way of referencing them.
Can you tell me more about your work with the Carolina Indian Circle and what role you played there?
Well, the Carolina Indian Circle, I was over in Raleigh about the time they were starting, so I went to a powwow or so that they had put on, but my first engagement, I guess, was when I came here in 88, 89, and I tried to attend their functions, but I didn't have an official role with them at the time, but I did have, I tried to be supportive of activities that Anthony Locklear was engaged with them. But when I started with the American Indian Studies, it was an opportunity then to be supportive. And working with students, you have to realize that, you know, as you get older, students are, you know, they need young people around, but they do need some people that can be advocates for them. But and so I wanted to find out more about them Indian students, so I went into the archives and found letters they had written and more information about challenges they've had in the past. And so we had, after I understood how to work with younger people, everything went well. I served as an advisor to the Carolina Indian Circle, First Nations Graduate Circle, and the Native American Law Students Association. And they all needed more than just an advisors. They all needed faculty, and we needed people to understand us at all levels. But, you know, you can still read as recent as last year where American Indian students at Carolina Indian Circle still feel a need for some attention to their issues. And, you know, I think we're moving in the right direction, but it's still, we've got a ways to go.
Did you work at all with the American Indian Center here on campus?
I was, yes, in some of their activities. While working with the American Indian Studies, the organization that helped with that was the Provost Committee on Native American Issues. And that committee was formed at the beginning in 97, I think, to look at American Indian Studies, but to look at other issues that would be important to the establishment of American Indian students and success of American Indian students. So the Provost Committee on Native American Issues, we talked about, and the issue came up that we needed something like an American Indian Center. So I was with the committee as we submitted proposals and received approval for funding of the American Indian Center. And so, you know, we've been partners between the American Indian Center, the students, and Indian Studies in a number of events, bringing in people to talk around Indian Heritage Month, but to engage in other kinds of dialogue to raise an awareness of American Indian issues.
Can you also tell me a little bit about your work with the Native American Law Student Association?
Well, that's another challenge there. Graduate students and professional students are very busy. And so, but we were able, I was able to meet with them. They welcomed my involvement with them. I would share information that I knew of events going on and be supportive as they sought to have programs or set up displays around Indian Heritage Month or raise some of the issues. One issue that they wanted was someone to teach American Indian law. And so there was the university contracted with a judge that was a judge at the Eastern Band of Cherokee to teach a course. And then over time now in the Department of American Indian Studies, we have a faculty that has a law degree and he's a member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa tribe. And so we have people around. But, you know, the students, they come and go. There's five or six students one year, then another year there's only one or two that are involved. And but it's really helpful. We have more Indian lawyers and doctors in North Carolina than probably per capita any other state in the union. And so the law school has been very good in producing Indian lawyers to go out and serve the communities.
Why do you think it's important to have Native American lawyers who are maybe more versed in tribal laws?
Well, because the tribal law is, you know, even with state recognized don't have as many issues as sometimes come up with the federal. But, you know, at Cherokee, I mean, they're just, there was an issue on the Cherokee reservation that the Cherokees could not arrest some people that committed crimes if they were white or not Indian. So it was just, and Indian law is just complicated with a lot of the issues that come up with American Indians. And it's difficult to explain just a few minutes, but it's, I think as students go out, graduate from Carolina and go out and serve in Indian communities or serve in any urban environment or around the state and around the country, the issues around Indian children come up. And there's the programs, the Indian Child Welfare programs, that seek to make sure that American Indians' children, if they are adopted or if they are in a situation that social services need to help them, that there's laws and provisions in place to help them stay connected to their culture. And so Indian law is very important, I think, to help the children for the most part, more than any other reason.
Absolutely. I know that you are a recipient of the extremely prestigious C. Knox Massey Award. Can you tell me a little bit more about that award?
Well, I was honored to be to receive that and to see that there was some recognition of activities that of American Indians on campus. I don't think I did anything extraordinary for any of that, but I was involved with a number of people that saw the need to include us. And so that was, you know, as much an award for the recognition that American Indians are part of this large community. And it was more about that, it was about me. And it was about Indian students that were here and asking for attention to their issues. And so in partnership with a number of faculty and administrators around Carolina, I was just, it was as much their award as it was for me.
What did it mean to you personally to receive that award?
Well, it was, you know, we always like people to recognize us or say positive things about us. And so it sort of validated some of the activities that I've been involved in, which, and a lot of counsel. I mean, there are a lot of people, administrators and faculty at Carolina that helped me understand what higher education is all about. When I first started working with Indian Studies, it was Mike Green and Theda Perdue, along with professor, they were professors in American Indian Studies and History, along with Professor Luddington. And then other administrators and all around that helped me understand how things worked. We couldn't always get things, as easily for Indian students and for connections to the Indian community, but I thought it was a recognition of that we were here, people were aware of our activities and what was needed, and set the stage for growth in a number of areas.
How do you think the perspective of Native American students has changed since when you first began working here at Carolina?
The perspective has changed some, but you know, when you look at Indian students coming from Indian communities, this is a major leap to come from a rural community to such a big city of UNC Chapel Hill. In the same way that is for non-Indian students coming here. You come from a rural area to Carolina. I mean, you might have been following Carolina basketball, football, or some other community people that have attended school here. But I think they're aware of a lot more resources that are here. They talk to some of their peers and family that have come to Carolina. More and more people have come to Carolina, so there's more people to talk with about the experience. But, you know, the student voice, though, is still not fully heard, I think. And we need to build a stronger relationship between the students and the faculty we have on campus, administrators, and, better understand student issues and help students better understand their place in, the university and what are they going to do when they leave Carolina? How can they be leaders and be change agents to help people get along a little bit better?
How do you think Native American students are represented on campus today?
What do you mean?
I guess just how do you think maybe Carolina represents Native American students, or
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, we can go. I know at the American Indian Center they have a big board where they have post-it notes, and students can post thoughts they have and aspirations. And I think that Carolina is moving forward in listening to students, but we need to help students be aware of how to think about Carolina, how to think about their lives. Coming from rural communities, sometimes it's a little bit more limited in courses and resources as some students come from urban environments. But then Indians, American Indians from urban environments don't have the cultural connection and resources that are most prevalent in the rural communities, tribal communities. So it's a delicate dance that I think we're moving forward on, but it's going to take more awareness building of Indian students and Indian communities about what higher education is all about and what higher education can do if the right kind of communication is going on.
What, in your opinion, could be done to help Native American students and student programs gain visibility here on campus?
Well, I think we need, what could we do? I have thought about we need more administrators. We have Indian faculty, we have an American Indian, director of the American Indian Center, director of the Center for the Study of the American South, but maybe in the chancellor's cabinet, on the provost, serving the provost areas. And then American Indian staff. You know, it's hard to, for Indian staff to move here, people to find the jobs up here. And the experiences in other places that Carolina requires for you to be employed. There's a lot of historically black schools where, and other environments where African Americans have had received some experiences that they could be hired here. We don't have that many American Indian. We have one American Indian University, Pembroke, and there's just our numbers are so small and. That have experiences in diversity issue activities and student affairs activities. But hopefully giving American Indians with the qualifications a chance to work in the university in a variety of settings, from student affairs to admissions, to other kinds of cultural activities. I mean, but building a larger group of staff would be very helpful, I think.
Absolutely. Do you have any ideas of other people you think would be integral to this project, or people whose stories you think we should capture, maybe other people we should interview?
Yes. I mean, there's a number of people, not many in this area, but... I know there's Bruce Jones that lives in Raleigh. He was the director of the Commission of Indian Affairs for many years. He has a lot of stories to tell. There's a number of people that tried to come to Carolina back in the 50s to attend Carolina, and Carolina would not accept American Indians for a long time. But some, like Dr. Ruth Dahl Woods in Pembroke area, she's, I think she got her PhD in education at Carolina, and there's a number of early students and undergraduate students, some in Raleigh, Pembroke, Clinton, Cherokee. I mean, we have a number of people that have come through Carolina and are fortunate to have graduated and gone back to contribute to their communities and their tribe. And so there's a long list of people. Some have experiences that would resonate, and some most do. And then there's another, the first American Indian woman to graduate from Carolina, Genevieve Lowry Cole, lives over in Durham. And I think she graduated in 55, 56. And so she has some stories to tell that would be, I think, helpful.
Absolutely. Is there anything today that we didn't get a chance to talk about that you would like to discuss with me? Anything even from your childhood to your family now, your experiences at Carolina?
No, there's a lot of other voices out there and a lot of other stories to be told. I think we, you know, as long as the stories are being collected and archived and, you know, that is an effort I hope that we can do more of, is archiving, helping the tribes to archive information about themselves, helping them tell the stories. You know, if Carolina can find a way and resources to do more archiving of information in the Indian communities, that would be my wish. And I think all is well, and especially with the, you know, we have American Indian Center here, the Center for the Study of American South, and American Indian and Indigenous Studies. And if we can help with the archaeology a little bit more, too. I mean, there's just a number of areas that, but Carolina is positioned well for engagement in these areas, and I look forward to hearing the next generation tell us about those stories about how that is moving along.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for agreeing to tell your story. It was amazing to talk to you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Bell. And I'll just shut this off now.